I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to ensure that all children have access to high-quality voluntary pre-kindergarten at pewtrusts.org.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, now serving dine-in, lunch, and dinner daily from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., featuring a Middle Eastern menu along with hot soup, Turkish coffee, and herbal teas. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a welcoming and inclusive community, and builders of the first green residence hall on the University of Illinois campus to use geothermal heating. Information about living at Presby Hall is available at www.presbyhall.com.
In the WILL severe weather coverage area, flash flood warning is in effect for the southern half of Champaign County until 3:30 this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're streaming online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Mark Sloan is a pediatrician who, over the course of his career, has attended nearly 3,000 births. Calling himself a pediatric grandfather, he's taken some time to reflect on his experiences and the history, science, and culture of birth. Dr. Sloan is the author of Birth Day, a pediatrician explores the science, the history, and the wonder of childbirth, and he is our guest this afternoon. He begins the book with a look back at the babies he delivered as a medical student. He was just starting his third year of medical school. It was June of 1977. He calls it his summer of babies. All in all, it was a pretty good summer, but he knew obstetrics was not for him. His next rotation was pediatrics, and that was that. Looking back on that summer of babies, Mark Sloan recalls being awestruck and terrified. He also thinks back on some other topics and thinks about the evolution of human childbirth, Louis XIV, and labor practices. The book goes on to look thoughtfully at a number of other issues surrounding childbirth, including pain, dads at delivery, and an up-close look at the body of the newborn. Listeners, I invite you to join our conversation with your questions and comments. The phone lines are open. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Dr. Mark Sloan, has been a pediatrician for more than 25 years. Since 1990, he's practiced medicine with the Permanente Medical Group in Santa Rosa, California. He earned his medical degree from the University of Illinois in Chicago in 1979. His writings have appeared in publications including the Chicago Tribune and San Francisco Chronicle. He, his wife Elizabeth, and their two children, Claire and John, live in Santa Rosa. Mark Sloan's book, Birthday, A Pediatrician Explores the Science, the History, and the Wonder of Childbirth, is published by Ballantine Books. Again, if you'd like to join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Sloan, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Celeste. Thank you. I'm doing fine. Thanks for inviting me on
the
program.
My pleasure. Well, tell us, first of all, about Tanya and what it was like delivering your first baby.
Well, it was completely unexpected to begin with. It was actually the first baby I'd ever seen born, period. I'm a product of the 1950s Irish Catholic upbringing, and all my aunts and mother and everybody else did a very good job of hiding their pregnancies. So I didn't have a real good background in how babies were born. But when I started my obstetrics rotation, which was the beginning of my third year at the University of Illinois Medical School, I didn't expect to have to do anything the first day, so I read about half the chapter about childbirth that night. And at that time, the OB staff in the hospital was short-staffed, so medical students were basically just thrown into the breach. And I was asked to just sit at the foot of a bed with a woman who was in labor and then just call for help when I saw a head start to emerge. And at the time, when it happened, no one was around, so they rescued me in time, but I almost had to deliver the baby myself and wished that I had read the rest of the chapter before.
So. You were really thrown into the pool, weren't you?
Yeah, it was a bit of a shock.
Yeah. You describe human childbirth as being like an Olympic bobsled run, but a very slow one.
Very slow one, yes.
Why that metaphor?
Well, if you compare how we give birth to our babies compared to other large primate species, say a gorilla, and I don't want to get in trouble for comparing gorillas to women. I'm being very careful about this. But the birth canal in gorillas is like a cylinder. The baby just goes straight from the mother's womb out into the world without any twists or turns. And the baby is actually, if you imagine a gorilla laying on her back, the baby would be facing the floor as it comes out. Well, humans, we're the only species of large primates that the baby actually comes out the other way, flipped over, looking at the ceiling. And that is the result of a lot of compromises over the millions of years with the evolution of our skeletons in general. And so our babies actually have to make twists and turns that the fetuses and babies of other species don't have to make. And so that was where I came up with these. It is kind of a very, very, very slow bobsled run with all the curves and twists.
Yeah, literally and figuratively painfully slow.
Yes.
Yeah. Why are babies born, as you describe it, neurologically half-baked? This gets us back to primates.
Yeah, our babies at birth, back to the gorilla analogy, gorilla babies have the skill level of about a one-year-old human at birth in terms of what they can do with their hands and getting from place to place and things like that. And this came about because there were several major adaptations the human female pelvis had to make in the course of our evolution. And the first was to upright walking. When we went from scampering around in the jungle to out into the grasslands, and our ancestors stood up, that made for changes in how we walked, which changed the shape of the pelvis to make it wider. The freed-up hands that allowed us to have, since we weren't walking on our knuckles, caused the shoulders to get wider. So, again, the female pelvis had to adapt by getting even wider. And then as we got brainier and our heads got bigger, the pelvis changed shape. And this was a continuous process, but then it started to change shape again in the front-to-back dimension. And it got to the point where there was only so much more accommodation a woman's pelvis could do to this, because if the pelvis got any wider or any deeper from front to back, it would make for a very awkward gait and make it very hard to flee from predators. So we came up with this the kind of ingenious idea of having our babies in earlier and earlier stages of development, so more and more of a baby's development actually happened outside the womb where it had happened inside the womb prior to that. So that made our babies end up being more and more helpless and created the situation where we really needed to have more of the village raising the child, because people needed to help because the children were pretty helpless for a fairly long period of time.
Mm. Thinking back now to Tanya, she delivered flat on her back. And this is so amazing to think back to now, what the year was, 1977. This delivery posture was with us for so long, and it goes all the way back to Louis XIV.
Yes. Louis was a bit of a voyeur, and he, up until that point, and still today in most cultures where you don't have westernized medicine, very, very few cultures do women labor on their backs. They usually squat or they walk around, and they take a variety of positions that are comfortable to them. But he wanted to see, he was very interested in childbirth, and he wanted to watch his mistress give birth. So he had his men construct what amounted to a viewing table And so he could then watch the baby as it was born. Now he kind of chickened out at the end and stood behind a curtain, but that was where that came from. And as soon as it became common news to obstetricians in the area that was the king's preference, it became the way to do it. And since French obstetricians were the creme de la creme of obstetricians, that point it spread very quickly to Europe, the rest of Europe, and then onward from there.
Mm. What do you suppose the Sun King would have thought about being a labor coach?
I think the fact that he hid behind a curtain says a lot.
Yeah. You write about this in Birthday, that the way dads handle being in the room, especially the first time out, runs the gamut, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some.
Well, it's changed. In the chapter that I call Daddies, I use my grandfather's experience in childbirth. My father just turned 90, and he remembers very, very clearly when his sister was born in their farmhouse in 1927. So I used his story of my grandfather to start that chapter, and and his role was basically go pick up the midwife and then get back out into the field, and then comparing that with my father's role at my birth, which was basically get mom to the hospital and mm-hmm. go home, and then suddenly a generation later where we're all expected to be labor coaches and very involved, and it's not an easy role for men. When my daughter was born in 1990, it was basically an expectation, you are the labor coach, and there is, except for the person who's actually going to deliver the baby, that was pretty much it for support. But things have kind of shifted back a little bit towards having especially experienced female friends or relatives there for the delivery as well, because that's how it was done up until the 20th century.
Yeah. Who's in the delivery room now besides mom and dad?
That is a very, it can be a lot of people.
Yeah.
The largest number of people I ever saw, and I wrote about this in the book, was I think 16 or 17, including a videographer the mother had hired for the occasion. But the norm when I was in medical school was exactly what we saw with Tanya. It was a woman laboring by herself in either a room or a little canvas partitioned area. And that's still fairly common in hospitals. If you go to especially South America, in Latin America, the laboring by yourself continues. But, it can be whoever the mother wants. And sometimes politically it's hard for her to not invite her mother-in-law or whoever.
So. Mm. Boy, that's a tough one. It's amazing to think how we've seen so many changes over the space of a generation and how readily accepted they've been, given the history that's gone before where things were, done in a certain way and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the a lot of the changes that we're just kind of emerging from now in terms of the, like when my mom had us back in the 50s, it was a very sterile process, and the mother was knocked out and forceps were used, and it really was, she was just kind of there to have her baby but not really be involved with it. But a lot of that comes from even the 19-teens when the big feminist movement, they had three major goals. One was to get the vote, one was to get equal pay for equal work, and the other was to get painless childbirth. And the painless childbirth movement actually ended up moving birth into the hospital. That's kind of where that started. So it was pretty much a century-long kind of transition.
Mm. How do the dads you've watched over the years deal with being there?
Well, it can range from fainting to not fainting.
Yeah.
Now, most of the dads do fine. I cannot rank myself highly as a labor coach because I had, in my defense, I'd been on call the night before, so I'd already been up 24 hours when this whole thing started and went on another 36 hours, so I kind of just fell asleep at one point. But it's a lot of dads are really good labor coaches. They really are in tune with, what their partner wants, but you bring your own personality to the labor room if you're the kind of guy who wants to be in charge of things, and that kind of comes out. For some people, it's just physically too much. It's just queasy making, and they'd rather have somebody take over that role too. So now the feeling is, the dad should be there if they want to be there, if their partner wants them to be there, of course. And if a father wants to be a coach, he should be a coach. He should take all the training and do that. But a father shouldn't be required to be a coach.
Yeah.
Men don't have a whole patch of their brain devoted to childbirth, so it's not a you know, no matter how much practice we get, it's not the same as if you have, you know, a female companion with you who's done this before and understands the feelings that you're going through.
Yeah. There's a dad you describe in the book. You call him Running Dad, and I was so impressed with how he wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work out for him.
He managed to knock himself out while running to a wrong hospital.
So. Yeah, poor guy. Well, let's go back to the position of lying flat on one's back. There was a fellow back in the 19th century, George Engelmann, a physician from St. Louis, who said, this doesn't make sense. We should be rethinking this. Who was he, and how was his thinking at the time received?
Well, George Engelmann he's from St. Louis. He was actually a prominent obstetrician. He was head of one of the precursors to the current American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And he just wondered why this would be. He said, you know, that it just mechanically didn't make sense to him, because in order to deliver your baby laying flat on your back, a woman literally has to push her baby uphill. And, you know, that's the direction of the birth canal. And so he looked at a number of, you know, from reports from around the world of different cultures and how women gave birth in those cultures, including slave culture in the United States. This was in the 1880s, so he was looking back at that. And he found out that none of those cultures, I think there was 30 of them he looked at, did the women lay flat on their back. In fact, all of them avoided it because it was an uncomfortable, awkward position to try to give birth in. So he put out his book. There's almost a bewildered tone to his book, you know, because he clearly what he grew up seeing as true was now being, you know, contravened by what he was seeing from around the world. And he put out his book, which was, you know, well received and then completely forgotten. Nobody really took him up on any of his recommendations. He really felt that women should probably be the safest place, or not the safest place, but the most efficient position for them to be in terms of delivering is whatever they find the most comfortable, because that's probably they're more comfortable because the baby's moving along the birth canal more efficiently.
And how are women assisted in that today?
Well, there is a lot more variety than there used to be. It's again, I usually get called into deliveries when there's a concern that the baby's not going to be healthy, so I'm not there for a lot of the early parts of this. But women nowadays, most Western women don't really have the leg power to squat as much as women in hunter-gatherer societies did. So what's kind of taken the place of that is a labor ball. It's like one of those big inflatable balls you can get for Pilates classes and things, and it that allows them to squat without, you know, exhausting their legs. And there are bars to hold on to, and there are, you know, the effort is to get women up and walking around and moving into comfortable positions. At least in the hospital I'm in, most women end up delivering not flat on their backs, but more of a semi-seated position that's just gravitationally just helps get the baby down the birth canal a lot better. So the kind of position I saw with Tanya, I think it's very rarely used anymore.
Yeah. You find yourself thinking about her from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you wonder what she would make of how far we've come.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder what, you know, whatever happened to her. I doubt she'd remember me as well as I remember her.
Yeah, well, for you it was.
I was just one of many little medical students running around there, I think.
Yeah. And for her, this was her third child.
Mm-hmm.
So she had some experience, but she wanted to sit up. She didn't.
Yeah, and then and that was what struck me in doing the research on the book later, is that she really was trying to do what George Engelmann had recommended, you know, in the 1880s, was let her get in a position that's comfortable for her. But I remember one nurse in particular kept just wrestling her back down and asking her, did she want to hurt her baby? And if she didn't want to hurt her baby, lay flat, just, you know, get this done with. And she was just trying to do what nature intended.
Yeah. What signals the fetus that it's time to go?
Nobody really knows, but there's a real complex hormonal chain that starts the whole thing going. What the actual trigger is, you know, in terms of starting labor is not completely clear yet. It's probably because it's probably a very, you know, very complex combination of things. But as far as the baby itself, the fetus itself, figuring some things out, the initiation of contractions is a signal for the baby to you know, make all the preparations with the lungs it needs to make to start breathing at birth. But also as the uterus contracts, the baby's getting more of its own blood that's been sitting in the placenta, pushed back into it, so there's an elevated blood pressure, and there's probably a sensation related to that, although, you know, what a fetus would really be feeling, it's pretty impossible to know.
Yeah. What kind of effort is required on the part of the fetus, their little bobsled driver?
They do a lot of pushing themselves. You know, now we tend to think of mom pushing this baby out, but it's really a team effort. Oftentimes, when we find babies who are, who are very sick at birth, or who, just don't, for whatever reason, perhaps are born with some sort of congenital problem with their muscles, oftentimes those labors are very long, and they end up with C-sections because the baby is not able to do its part in pushing itself out at the same time that the mother is doing it. So, really, both mom and you know, the baby are it's necessary for both of them to push in order to get a good efficient birth going.
Yeah, it's a pretty exhausting process.
Yeah.
Also, it's interesting to realize that if a newborn is delivered vaginally, mm-hmm. the head is different than by a cesarean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a cesarean baby has a much rounder head because that's how the head is in the womb. The cone head we associate with a vaginal birth is another one of those adaptations we made to try to get our babies out easier as our the baby's heads got bigger and the pelvis couldn't get any bigger. The bony plates of the skull really aren't fused together in the newborn, and they'll actually slide over each other a little bit. It narrows the diameter of the skull by about a centimeter to do that. And so it's another adaptation for helping the baby get out a little bit easier than if a baby who had a rigid skull probably couldn't get down the birth canal because their heads are a little bit too wide for that. And this is an adaptation that helps them get down there.
Yeah. It also says to me that that's some significant work that baby's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really the shoulders are the hardest part if they had to come down. They're wider than the head.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a midwife or an obstetrician will deliver one shoulder at a time, but that's another, that's really the limiting factor in getting out the birth canal. The head is tough enough, but the shoulders are even tougher. Mm.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Mark Sloan. He's a pediatrician with more than 25 years' experience. He's attended nearly 3,000 births over his career, and he's the author of Birthday, A Pediatrician Explores the Science, the History, and the Wonder of Childbirth. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What are the conversations like that you have with new parents? What do you want to tell them? What are they particularly curious about?
Well, I love new parents. I had planned on being a teacher before I got into medicine, and it is like being a teacher, you know, just trying to get them to understand, you know, why their baby's body looks the way it does at birth. And so you oftentimes spend a fair amount of time explaining the head shape, and sometimes the babies are bruised. Oftentimes they're furry little creatures. They'll have hair on their shoulders or in their ears. So you can kind of anticipate after all these years, or I can, you know, what things they're going to be concerned about. But the whole thing starts with getting the baby down naked in the mother's arms and just really going over exactly, you know, why the baby looks the way the baby does and what not to worry about, because oftentimes parents are afraid to ask about, like, the shape of the head because they're afraid they're going to be told something bad. So I just address all that stuff directly, and I enjoy that talk a lot. It's just a great moment.
Yeah. You said you considered being a teacher. What led you to medical school?
I went to Notre Dame, and my roommates were all going to medical school, so I was helping them. I was a biology major, so I was helping them drill on their medical college admissions test, the little flashcards and things, and I thought, you know, I could probably take this test. So I took the test, and I did well on it. And I thought, well, I probably could go to medical school, and then I worked in a clinic over a summer just to see if I liked it, and I did. So that's how I kind of got into it, because of my roommates.
When you began, did you have any inkling that pediatrics would be your calling?
Initially, I thought I would be a family practice doctor or a GP. The GPs, as we used to think of them, were kind of fading out in those days. But I was thinking of family practice. I was thinking of maybe surgery. I didn't really know. I liked children a lot. I've always been fascinated with babies since I was a little kid. But I thought probably family practice was where I was going to go.
Yeah. Now, I've heard that pediatricians might be a dying breed, that we might be going in the direction of family practice. Is that true?
Well, there's always going to be a need for pediatricians because there's always going to be complicatedly ill children. Like in where I am in Santa Rosa, we have a large number of our family practitioners who see kids, but when things start to get complicated, say a child with bad asthma or diabetes or things like that, they tend to refer them over for care to us. But it is true. I mean, pediatrics has changed an awful lot since I started because a lot of the infectious diseases that I saw routinely when I was starting out, we don't see anymore because of vaccinations, or we don't see them very often. I do worry they are going to come back because of vaccination rates dropping. But, for instance, I think the last case of measles I saw was probably 1978 or 9, I would imagine. Mm. And there were some very dangerous bacteria that caused meningitis, caused pneumonias, even into the 1980s and early 90s, and vaccines came out for those, and it's been a long time since I've seen, and I'm happy that I haven't seen it. But on the other hand, that was part of my role, was to know when a kid was that ill and jump in there and do something, and we just don't see that much
anymore. I wonder if pediatrics becomes a field where the children are really ill, if that would be a more challenging specialty.
It would be. To me, I don't think it would be as enjoyable for me personally because I really like the continuity of following families through, health and illness and everything else. And for a while I considered, when I was first starting out, going into neonatology, taking care of just sick babies. But I thought, then they're gone and you don't see the family again. And I really like the idea of the continuity. But I think that's, you're probably right, that's probably where it's heading, is that more and more pediatricians will be either specialists or hospitalists, meaning they just work in the hospital, or caring for chronically ill children in the outpatient setting.
Yeah. Well, it's got to be really rewarding when someone you were the doctor for when they were little kids comes to you with their own children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm getting more and more of those now. It is funny how the role changes, and suddenly I'm not talking to them like kids anymore, and they're... Some of them aren't quite ready to not be talked to with like kids, but gotta shake them up and get them going here. But no, I have a growing. That's why the term I use, pediatric grandfather. It's the children of the children I took care of. More and more of those I'm seeing now.
Yeah. Well, the pediatrician, looking back on it, when I was a kid, I really loved my two pediatricians. So
all I can remember of my pediatrician is that he had very cold hands. We didn't go in very often.
Really?
He froze me every time I'd go and get examined.
Yeah, there was that. There was that. And
I always warm my hands in memory.
Oh, you're so good. I also remember this doctor. My parents had all four of us in to get vaccinated. I can't remember what the vaccination was. And I was kind of hiding out in the back, and he made a beeline right for me. He, I'm sure he knew exactly what I was up to. It was like, and he hit me first, so I didn't have time to squawk or run away.
Yeah, so. You learn to play the crowd there.
Well, back in 1977, when you delivered some babies there in Chicago, 20 babies that summer. What a summer! Were they all delivered vaginally?
Mm-hmm. Of the ones that I'm referring to, there. Yeah. We also went to I would go to C-sections just to help hold, clamps and things.
Yeah.
But the ones, and that was an unusual number because normally, had they been staffed well enough, a medical student would have delivered maybe three or four, of the most uncomplicated ones. But they were just sort of short-staffed. I mean, I wasn't by myself. I would be working on delivering a baby, and around the corner would be the resident in case something was going on. But it was pretty borderline chaotic.
Yeah. And there was that baby that started to come butt first.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was set up on that one. Yeah. I couldn't tell it was a breach, that this was the bottom coming out, and I, of course, because I'd never seen anything like that. And then suddenly the baby started to have a bowel movement, and the only conclusion I could come to was that the baby's head was exploding, and they came and saved me on that one, too. But but it was about the time I figured, you know, maybe this isn't for me.
Yeah. Well, also, it was a teaching moment, so to speak, for you, because you were getting a little overconfident there.
Well, you'd have to know Mitch, the resident I write about. Yeah. I think he was trying to get me. So. He may have been teaching somehow, but he was enjoying himself.
You know whatever happened to Mitch?
Yeah, I actually looked him up. I Googled him, and I won't say where he's in practice, but I'll say he's east of the Mississippi. He might come back after me.
Yeah.
Not sure, but yeah, he's still in practice.
Yeah.
I don't know how his practice is doing. But
yeah. Well, you write a fair amount in this book, Birthday, about the cesarean section. And it has increased so dramatically over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, it's up until the middle of the 19th century, late 19th century, it was cesarean sections were just desperation. You were trying as best you could to get a live baby out of a very bad situation, and I almost always failed. You know, usually the mother and the child both died, so it was just clearly just desperation. But then. With the introduction of ether and chloroform, that gave doctors more time to do the surgery, then came improved techniques, and then the introduction of antibiotics in the 1930s, suddenly it got to be a much safer operation. So even then, though, by the time I graduated from high school in 71, the U.S. cesarean rate was 6%, and right now it's probably around 33%. And the big jump came in the 80s, early 90s when we started doing the electronic fetal monitoring, where there was continuous monitoring of a fetus's heart rate. And we started to see things that people hadn't seen before. You know, in the days before that, when a nurse would come around every 10 or 15 minutes and listen with the stethoscope and make sure the baby's heart rate was fine, nobody knew what was going on in between times. So oftentimes a fetus would get, have an odd-looking heart pattern that got better and nobody was the wiser. But when we started seeing those, then people started to jump quicker to do cesarean sections because the fear was this is a baby in trouble, and there was not really a good way to tell if the baby was going to pull out of this on its own or not. In those days, too, there was a lot of lawsuits started because the assumption was if something happened to a baby, if a baby was damaged, it was the obstetrician's fault that this had happened, even if this was a baby who was probably damaged long before, birth by an infection or something. And so the people's minds work, they were less likely to sue if you did something as opposed to if you did not do something. So if you did a C-section, it was actually apparent, at least felt like you tried. If you waited to see if this thing sorted itself out, oftentimes there was more blame assigned to the doctor. So being an obstetrician is pretty tough in those situations.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that raised it quite a bit. Then but there wasn't much. It got up into the 20-25% range about 1985 and hovered there for about 15 years. It didn't really move very much. There was a trend to vaginal birth after cesarean section, which actually saw the C-section rates start to decrease for a while. But then concerns came came about that there was a very small number of women actually had emergency surgery because they tried to have a vaginal birth after a cesarean and had a uterine rupture, which is a big emergency. And as a result, I think it was 1998, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists ruled that unless you have 24-hour anesthetic coverage in your hospital that can get there right away, then you should not be trying to do vaginal births after cesarean, and you should just be doing repeat cesarean. Mm. And that's when it really started to take off again. So, so from 2000 to now, I think there's something along. I'm guessing, I think I got the number right, but I think it's about 300,000 babies more a year are born by C-section than there were in 2000, and primarily because of that.
Yeah. How many babies are born by elective primary cesarean?
It's a growing number in the U.S. Now, elective primary cesarean, and this means, but just for people listening, it's a woman who decides to have a cesarean section, particularly with her first baby, without having no medical reason for it, just bypassing labor and wanting to have a cesarean done. It's a very common practice in Latin America, especially amongst wealthier women, and there's a lot of cultural reasons behind that. But you know, in some areas the C-section rate is about 80% in parts of Latin America. The elective primary I worry about as a pediatrician, because the studies so far have been primarily looked at by obstetricians and anesthesiologists, and they're, understandably their concern is the mom and that we've got a healthy baby leaving the hospital. What we don't know is what happens to those babies down the road, because some recent studies have showed that babies who have cesareans for any reason are at somewhat more, you know, it's slight, but it is noticeable, they're at more risk for developing asthma or eczema down the road, several years down the road. Hmm. So there's probably something going on during labor that is fine-tuning a child's immune system, because those are immune system disorders, asthma and eczema. And during labor, a mother floods her baby with antioxidants. You know, these things we're always trying to get that help prevent cancer, et cetera. That doesn't happen if you don't go into labor. The other thing is that even years down the road, you'll find bacteria in the intestines of people who were born vaginally versus those who were born by cesarean are very different. And it's those bacteria that kind of teach your immune system what's normal, what isn't, what's good, what's bad. And so there may be something going on there, and it does concern me because it's barely been looked at, and yet we have people, you know, marching ahead with these elective primary cesareans, and it's worrying to me as a pediatrician.
Yeah. Your son John was born by C-section, by necessity,
mm-hmm.
And there's a beautiful photo of him at the outset of the first part of the book.
Taken by me, I will point out.
His arms and fingers are outstretched. It looks like he's ready to embrace the world. Is that typical?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what he's doing there is he's having what's called a Moro reflex, where none of us can imagine we all went through it, but I'm sure none of us, although some people claim to remember, can really remember what it's like to go from the confines of the womb out into this totally bizarre environment,
yeah.
You know, cold and loud and bright. And so a natural tendency for babies is to shoot out their arms to grab, and what they'd be grabbing for, you know, if we go back into evolutionary history, is mom. You know, it's just when you're born, the first thing you want to do is grab onto your mother and hold on. So that's what he's doing in that picture. And yeah, when babies are first born, they'll come out, and along with that big cry, they usually will throw out their arms because they're looking for security.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, pediatrician Dr. Mark Sloan. He's the author of Birthday, A Pediatrician Explores the Science, the History, and the Wonder of Childbirth. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Savoy on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. Hello, Dr. Sloan. I had a baby before your time in 1961
mm-hmm.
at home, and it was a home birth. And I was attended by the Chicago Medical Center or clinic or whatever, which was a group of doctors, residents, and one intern from Northwestern, and I think the U of I at Baby University. Rush or someplace like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was a wonderful occasion, and I'm an advocate of no anesthetic because the babies are so alert and so, you know, they're not drugged when they're born.
Mm-hmm.
My baby was alert. He did not cry. He came out talking. He was, you know, how do babies murmur and babbling to the nurses and doctors, and they were just astonished.
Mm-hmm.
And I advocate, if not home birth, at least natural birth. Mm-hmm. And I had been self-educated through reading the book published by that South African doctor, I can't remember him.
Oh, you're thinking Grantley Dick Rees?
Yes, Grantley
yeah.
Dick Rees. That's a must for mothers for delivery. And I highly recommend it. But I wanted to say that when I got to the final stages, I had the urge to reach up and pull on my under my thighs, you know, to help expel at the last moment. And all of the medical attendants took my hands away. They said, "You can't do that. That area is sterile." They had rubbed it down, you know, with that antiseptic. And that was the only unfortunate part of the birthing process, was that I couldn't help myself because I knew what I needed to do.
And I'm sure you're right, too.
And as a result, they had to remove his head with forceps.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, that episiotomies aren't pleasant either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's my contribution.
Well, I think you're right. I think the very healthiest way to have babies is vaginally, you know, do that naturally. And I think that more and more people are trying to move in that direction. The hard part is, you know, I don't know if your mother or anybody was around at that point too, but we're losing more and more the ability to have an older relative or friend who's gone through a natural birth to help talk a woman through a natural birth. Because if a third of our babies are born by C-section and the bulk of the rest of them have epidurals, that's a kind of a cultural thing that's being lost rather rapidly. So, and a lot of people are working to try to bring that back.
Anything new on the horizon as far as pain control?
Not, well...
For childbirth.
Depends on where you are. Now, in the United States, it's pretty much, you know, if you're going to go do hospital birth, you're limited to epidurals or narcotic injections or local anesthetic injections. Again, that's a generalization because it varies from place to place. But when I wrote about... I thought the section of my book on pain management was going to be very slim, and it ended up being a whole section of the book. And it started because I just wanted to look and see what epidural rates were in Europe versus the United States. And I saw that they were lower. You know, they're creeping up like ours are. But what I kept seeing was nitrous oxide mentioned, you know, laughing gas like you get at the dental the dentist's office. And I thought, well, that's interesting. 70% of normally laboring women in Britain use nitrous at some point. And I wondered, gee, what's the rates here in the U.S.? And I couldn't find it. And through some digging, I found out there's really only two hospitals in the U.S. who, as far as I know, that offer it, and one of them is at University of California, San Francisco, and the other one's University of Washington. And I live near UC San Francisco, so I drove down there to talk to the fellow who runs their obstetric anesthesia program, Mark Rosen, and he's very much in favor of it. As the British call it good enough pain relief. You know, we tend to be focused on obliterating pain.
Mm-hmm.
There they just want to, you know, a lot of women just would like, you know, if they can't get through it naturally, and a lot of times it's more painful than they thought, or the baby's in an awkward position or something like that. It's a moderately effective pain reliever. It kind of makes you not care that you're having pain, and the nice thing about it is that it's self-administered. A woman can, she holds a mask to her face. When she takes it off, she's back to normal in about two or three breaths. It doesn't take very long to get out of your system.
Yeah.
So there's a movement afoot that I got myself involved in here. Another one of these things I didn't know was going to happen writing a book. But Judith Rooks, who's a midwife in Portland, is part of a group of midwives and other birthing specialists who are trying to bring nitrous oxide back into labor rooms in the U.S. as something between, you know, no medication at all and an epidural, you know, and I think they'll be successful with it. But so what's new may be something that's quite old, actually. It's been around a long time.
Yeah. Let's take one more call this afternoon. Another listener in Savoy on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey there.
I teach prepared childbirth, and we try really hard to explain to people what's going on and what they can do. And I use a whole bunch of techniques. I'm certainly not against medication and epidural if it's needed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of women come into it saying, well, I'm going to have an epidural.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what they're going to do without examining or looking at what the alternatives are.
Mm-hmm.
And the alternative for prepared childbirth is much better for the baby, much better for the mom.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, it's allowing what's supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
and
it is around.
I'm sorry?
So we do teach that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things I talk about in the book, too, is that A lot of women just assume they're going to have an epidural, and they don't really, when they're signing their consents, I talk to a lot of mothers at their two-week baby visit and at their two-month baby visit, and then when they're coming back pregnant the next time. And a lot of women second-guess themselves either direction. You know, either they did it without an epidural, and they really wish they would have had something more for pain, which is where nitrous might fit in there. Or they didn't, when they signed up for the epidural, they didn't realize they're going to have an IV. They're going to have to stay in bed.
Right.
They're going to
have
that confined feeling. And it can give you headaches. It can give you all kinds of things. So it relieves pain, but it's not without some cost.
Oh, no.
So looking at European study or data, again, too, and I'm including Canada, I should say this, too. They include a huge array of pain relievers that are available, from acupuncture to acupressure to hypnobirth, to all kinds of things like that. And they're much more routinely used there because, I'll readily admit I've never had a baby, but, it's such a subjective pain experience because every woman comes into this with whatever's happened to her whole life before that.
And the more she knows about it, the easier or the better it's going to be.
Yeah.
It's never pain-free.
No.
It just doesn't happen that way.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to let you know that we do stuff here.
Great.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We've got to wrap up here. And I mentioned that beautiful photo of your son. Well, now there's a beautiful photo of Claire in the book as well with her baby brother on her lap. To wrap up here, she is clearly enjoying the wonder of her little brother.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us to wrap up here about what babies might be experiencing in the world as they are so brand new?
Well, I have a chapter about the five senses at birth, and also talks about the five senses in late fetushood. When you're ready to be born, and at birth, babies can hear pretty much the way they can. Well, a fetus in the womb hears mainly bass sounds, low sounds, because the tissues of the womb and abdomen block out a lot of the high pitched noises, so they hear kind of boombox sounding noise. At birth, though, their hearing is almost the same as an adult's. They can it's quite loud, obviously, because before this has been muffled a bit. I always pride myself on the fact that I have newborn vision. I'm about 2300, 2400 in that range, and I can see clearly about 8 to 12 inches from objects that close to me, and that is exactly a baby at birth can see clearly about a foot away, and that's exactly the distance from the breast to mother's face. They smell and taste everything a mother eats in the third trimester, which is probably where a lot of our cultural food preferences come from, and they're very, very much wanting to be touched. In fact, there were studies done in premature babies showing that if someone just came in and massaged them a little bit every day, they gained weight faster, they went home quicker, So all those senses are up and going in the third trimester and right at birth, and they're all geared towards trying to help a baby, figure out, okay, who am I looking for and where's that food coming from and who's going to take care of me?
Yeah. Wonderful beings. Babies.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Sloan, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Mark Sloan is a pediatrician. He's the author of Birthday, A Pediatrician Explores the Science, the History, and the Wonder of Childbirth. The publisher is Ballantine Books. It's 1:54 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Chicago and Kansas City.
Hey, afternoon. Rather Friday afternoon. Kind of wish it was a Friday afternoon. It's a Wednesday afternoon. Here we go. Make contract in the wheat pit, 3.75 lower. The settlement price, the high at 589.5, a low at 577.75. Settlement price at 578.75, down 3.75. July futures, 602.25, the high, the low at 83.75. Settlement price at $5.88.75, down 4 cents. In September, 628, the high, the low at 10.5. Settlement price at 615.25, down 4.25. In December futures, 651.25, the high, the low at 32.5. Settlement price at 637.5, down 4.25. May wheat futures in Kansas City, a 635 settlement price, up a penny. July, up a half at 638. From the corn pit, back in Chicago, unchanged in the nearby contract, $4.26.5, the May high, the low at 415. That lead option May contract settled unchanged at $4.19.5. July futures, 434, the high, low at 21.25, settlement price at $4.26.5, down a penny. In September, 443.25, the high, the low at 30.5, settlement price at $4.35.5, down 0.75 cents. December futures, the harvest month in the corn pit, 455.5, the high, The low at 442, a settlement price at 447 and a quarter, down 0.75 cents. March futures 466, the high, the low at 52.5. March 2010, corn 457 and 0.75, a settlement price there, down a penny on the afternoon. May oat futures were 6.5 lower, 225. July at 228.5, down 7. Soy complex, May beans, $11.56 and 0.75, the high. The low at 11.35, settlement price at 11.50, 12.5 cents higher on the afternoon. July futures today, an 11.41 high, low at 11.12 and a half, and a settlement price at 11.28, up 10.5 cents for the July soybean futures. September futures, 10.95 and a quarter, the high, the low at 10.70 and a quarter. Settlement price at 10.85, up a dime, and September futures 10.42, the high, the low at 15.75. Settlement price at $10.27, up 3.5. November futures now, the harvest month, $9.98 and 3/4, the high, low at 9.71 and a quarter. Settlement price at $9.81 and a half, up 2. In the January contract, 3.25 higher at $9.87. May bean meal at $3.78.50 was up $12.30 for the day. May bean oil at $38.90. down 49. I'll be back in just about 9 minutes during the closing market report. We'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Livestock contracts finished lower today in Chicago. June live cattle, 83.25, the high, 82.37.5, the low. The settlement, 82.50, that down 70. August, 83.52.5, the high, 82.77.5, the low, 82.82.5, the settlement, that down 75. October, 88.60, the high, 87.85, the low, the settlement, 88.25, that down 45. December, 91 even, the high, 90.20, the low, the settlement, 90.77.5, that down 12.5. May feeder cattle, 99.30, the high, 98.85, the low, 98.95, the settlement, that down 37.5. August, 102.10, the high, $100.60, the low, 101.22.5, the settlement, that down 22.5. September, 102.10, the high, $100.75, the low, 101.55, the settlement, that unchanged. October, 102.25, the high, 101.10, the low, the settlement, 101.75, that down 30. May lean hog, 61.95, the high, 61.40, the low, 61.57.5, the settlement, that down 17.5. June, 68.55, the high, 67.80, the low, the settlement, 67.95, down 97.5. July, 70.25, the high, 69.15, the low, the settlement, 69.47.5, down 112.5. August, 70.60, the high, 69.30, the low, 69.37.5, the settlement, that down 147.5. And May bellies, 76.80, the high, 76.57.5, the low, the settlement, 76.80, that down 120. Let's take a look now at Wall Street. The Dow is off 160 points at 8309, the NASDAQ down 41 at 1675, the S&P 500 down 20 at 888, and the price of oil, nearby crude, a barrel down 83 cents at 5803. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, a flash flood warning continues for the southern half of Champaign County until 3:30 this afternoon. Also, urban and small stream flood advisories are in effect for portions of McLean and DeWitt counties and all of Piatt County until 3:30 this afternoon. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon, mostly cloudy, windy, and warmer with periods.